Some months, you're flooded with jobs and make multiple placements. Other months, a big fat zero. This feast and famine cycle isn't just stressful, it's holding you back and keeping you from real predictable growth. Here's the good news. There's a reason it's happening, and you can fix it. The 7-Figure Freedom Scorecard is a free tool designed for recruitment business owners. In less than 10 minutes, it evaluates your firm across the 6 key pillars of sustainable growth: clients, candidates, team, operations, marketing, and strategy. Your personalized scorecard will reveal what's working and what's broken, and the fastest way to build a recruitment business that generates consistent 7-figure revenue month after month. Stop riding the revenue roller coaster and take the free scorecard now at recruitmentcoach.com/scorecard.
I ended up placing someone at a $300,000 salary for a $60,000 fee. Yeah, the interesting thing was, right after that deal got done, they fired me.
After getting fired from his first recruiting job, Brendan Thomas could have walked away from the industry. Instead, he started over at JobBot. Over the next 5 years, he generated $5 million in billings while leading a high-performing team.
I was starting at the place I'm at now by June 22nd was my first day. From June 22nd to December 31st, I billed over $600,000.
I'm Mark Whitby, and you're listening to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. In this episode, Brendan shares exactly how he breaks into major enterprise clients that provide ongoing repeat business and a high volume of placements.
I picked up enough of the enterprise accounts over year to where once I proved myself with those enterprise accounts, basically they're like, hey, we like working with you and your company. Why don't you just take a shot at any of the jobs we have posted? We'll let you work all of them. Then they start getting you into, they give you access to their ATS. Now you're loading candidates directly in there. They give you access to the hiring manager's calendars. Now you're booking the interviews for them. Eventually the hiring managers want to speak with you because they're like, hey, this guy's found me 3 rock stars so far. I want to talk to this guy.
Brendan walks through how he gets access to hiring managers, how he works with HR and talent acquisition instead of fighting them, and how he turns a single opening into a long-term partnership inside complex organizations.
And it's important to present a real candidate. I know there is some stigma in the space about sending submittals or sending out candidate profiles that's just a perfect profile for the job. And then they say, sure, send me that resume. And then you got to scramble to find somebody. Go find a real candidate that's looking for a job. It's not difficult to do.
He's also very honest about the work it takes, the long hours, the rejection, the sustained effort required to perform at this level year after year. If you want a practical, real-world playbook for developing enterprise accounts, and you're prepared to hear what it actually takes to succeed, this conversation is for you. All right, Brendan, great to see you again. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Fantastic. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited.
So you and I chatted before, and I'm really excited about getting into this because you've achieved so much, and I want to really dig into, the specifics of how you've been able to be a million-dollar biller for multiple years in a row while leading a team and breaking into enterprise accounts and all that good stuff. So we're going to get into that. But first, tell me the story of how you got into recruiting, because I think it was a little different to how many of us did.
Yeah. Oh boy. So I'll try and give you the abbreviated version, but it's funny. I've been in sales and marketing my whole life, and growing up, I thought I wanted to be in product marketing, right? Like tangible physical products. And that's what I pursued. So I got into, worked at retail, was thinking maybe going the fashion route. And then kind of lost interest in that. Then I went into events and thought, well, maybe experiences is more what I'm interested in, right? And so started working in events, and that was great. Had a lot of fun doing that. And then when my wife and I decided to, start talking about settling down and having children, the schedule I had when I was marketing events was just not a schedule that would be conducive for starting a family. So had to figure it out quick. I actually went in and got my license to sell insurance first. did not like that space. The product just was not for me, especially in the state of California. It's extremely difficult. But then a friend of my wife, we were hanging out one day and hanging out at a pool party at a hotel, having a few drinks. And she said, you know, I think you could be really good at recruiting. And I was like many people probably, I thought recruiting was maybe like, you know, I'm trying to recruit college kids to their first job, which nothing wrong with that. But I had no clue there was different levels to the staffing space. Just had no clue. So she convinced me to give it a try. Definitely had nothing to lose. I was very much burned out on insurance. So ended up meeting with the first agency I worked at. Hit it off with the guys that I interviewed with. It seemed like a good group. And so they made me an offer and I took it. And I haven't looked back since.
All right. So how old were you when you got that? Because you'd already had a career before that.
Yeah. Yeah. I was definitely walking into the office the first week. I definitely noticed pretty quickly I was not the youngest there. So it was in January of 2020. So I just hit really my 6 years, 6 year mark in this space. And so I was 36. So definitely, you know, what most people consider full swing in the peak, you know, starting the peak of your career. And here I was starting something completely new. So it didn't bother me though. Yeah, it didn't bother me. I had like energy. The energy in the office was awesome. I mean, there was people there from, you know, post, just fresh out of college all the way up to 50, 55, even 60 years old. So it felt comfortable, but yeah.
All right. Awesome. And how did it go?
The first place went horribly wrong or terribly.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. To be honest with you. It was I think it was a culmination of things, right? Like I was learning a new business model, right? I was learning, this is the first time in my life that the product was a service I was providing. And also, you know, if we're working with clients, with businesses, then your product is a human, right? And so that was very new for me. Some parallels to my event career where I was like booking talent and I had to locate the right type of musicians or artists that were going to sell out, you know, a room. So there was some small parallels there, but still very different. So I had to not only learn something brand new, thankfully I at least had a sales muscle. So at least it wasn't my first sales job. That was helpful. But the agency I worked at, they had what they thought was the best path to success. And no knock to them. I think they just felt that this was the right path, which was only technology. So day one, they wanted me to start, you know, trying to go after companies that needed to hire software engineers, which I'm 42 now. Computers were around when I was in school, of course, but we weren't coding. We weren't doing any, you know, maybe what like, let's say someone in their 20s right now probably coded in school. They're pretty familiar with that whole ecosystem. I was clueless. So yeah, to say it was a shell shock would be an understatement. So didn't go well at first. I started in January of 2020. So when Q1 ended, I was at zero. I had leads. I was able to connect with candidates. I was able to get some interviews booked. So for me, it was a huge win. But when I sat down after my first quarter and spoke with my managers, they were like, hey, you've got to have to pull a miracle in the next month or two and you're out of here. And I was like, what?
Wow.
I was like, I'm pretty impressed by just getting some interviews booked and picking up some clients. But yeah, they were not impressed.
It's so interesting because like we'll come on to this when we talk about you as a billing manager, but I know from having worked with hundreds of different recruitment businesses that it does take time. Like it takes 3 to 6 months to start, you know, getting traction, and you're even a year before you're really fully, you know, up and running. Right. And so it seems premature to, and at 3 months in, you know, to already tell you, like, give you the warning that like your days are numbered. That sounds a bit drastic, but do you agree with them or do you think they made a terrible mistake?
Well, so, you know, it's twofold. Okay. So I agree with you now that I've hired people and trained folks. Granted, the company I work at now, we don't hire people that that don't have previous staffing or recruiting experience. So it's different. I'm not having to teach people the fundamentals of the job. They do have that. I'm helping them to unlock, you know, maybe a next level of production that they're having a trouble unlocking. So that's really my job now. But looking back on it, I think that previous agency, I think they just had a mentality where after the first 3 months, they kind of got a feel for what they think you're capable of. And then I think I was on a PIP after my fourth month. But the funny thing was I made my first placement at the end of my fourth month, and it was a software engineer. It was a $15,000 placement, 15, 1-5, right? So very junior engineer. And it was a 20% fee with a pretty small company. And of course, I was ecstatic. You know, I got someone to the finish line. But what was interesting was my manager told me to stick to software engineering. What he didn't know, because we all went home and went remote because of the pandemic, he didn't have full visibility. So what he didn't know was that I actually ventured off and I went for, it was actually a pharmaceutical company. And I just went after their highest paying jobs. I figured if I'm doing all this work, why wouldn't I do it for the highest paying jobs I can find and see what happens, right? So I remember to this day, the company, I won't mention them, but at one point, the HR manager kind of alluded to the fact that he's like, I can tell you're a bit new to this, but that's okay. You are finding us the right people. So let's keep at it. And that company had a 25% fee sign, and I ended up placing someone at a $300,000 salary for a $60,000 fee. The interesting thing was right after that deal got done, they fired me. So
what?
Oh, yeah, man. I think it was a little bit of ego, maybe a little insubordination. And then also I won't get into the particulars, but let's just say if someone gets let go before a bill gets paid, that money gets distributed in a different way.
Of course.
So
yeah. You we'll don't get the commission for that. But look, I can see two sides of this. One being, if they specialize in technology, say, and you're going off and doing pharmaceutical, then it's like you're operating outside of their, you know, their niche market. So
yeah.
Do you know what? It sounds like that maybe just wasn't a fit for you, but thank
Correct.
Goodness, right? Because you've gone on to do great things. So they did you a favor. And looking back at all of the setbacks, the disappointments, the, you know, kicks in the balls that I've had over the years, it feels horrible at the time, but then it's always led to something even better. So
100%. Yep. 100%. I actually, you know, when they let me go, I immediately reached out to the CEO of the company that I work at now. And I was very direct. I told her, look, hey, this is the situation. And oddly enough, my managers that I first worked with, the ones that I interviewed with that actually hired me, they had left after just the first few months of me working there to work at the company I'm at now. And so I think I tore her heartstrings a little bit. I was like, look, I really like this industry. I was able to knock out a couple deals. I'm definitely still green. I've got 6 months of experience, but you took my manager and I really want another shot at it. So I'll do whatever it takes. If you want to ask the manager if he'll vouch for me. But if you just give me an opportunity, I don't care where I start. I just want a shot at it because I think I can do this. I think I finally figured it out. And thankfully, she said, yeah, let's do it. And then I ended up. So in January of 2020 was when I started at the first agency. I was gone by June 15th-ish, somewhere around there. I was starting at the place I'm at now by June 22nd was my first day. And from June 22nd to December 31st, I billed over $600,000.
Wow, that's awesome, man. how did you know that you, like, because that first experience would have put a lot of people off and they might have gone, ugh, I don't like this industry or this isn't what I want to do. What was it that made you think, no, I actually think I could be great at this and this is what I want to really focus on?
Yeah, no, good, really good question. And you're right. I'd be lying if I said there wasn't a little bit of that, right? Like it was more so a question of, at what capacity do I want to do this job? Not so much like I want out of this industry, it's not for me. I felt very much that way about insurance. I thought insurance was going to be more of a job where I would be helping people protect their assets, hedging against, risk and stuff like that. It ended up being very, very different than that. But I was very, my convictions were strong when I said, okay, I want out of the insurance space. And I didn't fail in that space. It just wasn't fast paced enough. There wasn't enough opportunity and it couldn't grow quickly. So what excited me about the staffing space is I could see that you could ramp up once you get a good book of business. You could be successful in a year, and the insurance space, I was prepared to be in that space for 5, 6, maybe 7 years until I'd be successful enough to raise a family. So I would say that it was the appeal of the fact that, you eat what you kill. And as long as I was able to work for an agency that would allow me to go after any vertical, anywhere in the country, no handcuffs, any type of job, that to me, I call it an intrapreneur role because it felt very much like, hey, I can run my own business within this business and they'll support me on the stuff I don't want to do and I can focus on the things I like. So back to your question, of course, there was a moment of like, man, do I really want to start all over? But unlike a lot of people, I only had 6 months. I only had 2 clients. I had only done 2 deals. So starting over was not a big deal for me. I actually ended up working with one of the 2 clients and they're still a client to this day. I had enough conviction that I wanted to stay in it.
So your description of a business within a business, it's funny because that's exactly the way I thought about it. When 30 years ago, I got my first job in an agency running a desk. And that's how I looked at it as well. Even though I was an employee, I really thought of it as, I have autonomy. I can decide, like, my billings, my income is up to my own, efforts. And I love, that's one of the things I loved about this industry. So look, just some of your stats. So total lifetime billings of over 5 million, average annual billings 1 million, 6 years in a row, CEO club, qualified for every quarterly event. Now you alluded to one of your kind of strategies, which is go after higher paying positions. So I know your average placement value is about $40,000 average fee value, right? But what does it really take to build a $1 million business, $1 million a year?
Sure. Yeah. And I feel like there are different paths for different people to get to $1 million+ per year. And I know I've learned in the 6 years I've been in this space that seems to be this coveted number. I know people who do $2 million a year but they've been doing it for 15, 20 years, right? So it's that repeat client and they keep building those repeat clients and they get to a place where business development isn't so necessary because they have enough repeat business to keep them busy throughout the year. Maybe they hit a spot where they can do a little bit of business development if they have, for example, a large amount of a very specific requisition for one company. Well, maybe I should see if there's a few others in that area so I can spread those candidates out, have a higher chance of placing more people. And I don't mean to jump around too much, but that is one way. But so to start to kind of backtrack for a minute, I reached out to everyone I knew that was billing somewhere near $1 million or more. And I just asked them, I don't need your copywriting or I don't need your client list. I don't need anything that you deem proprietary or your secret sauce, if you will, just your approach, just how you're finding this repeatable success. That's all I ask for. And I've found that even though staffing and recruiting can be extremely competitive, I've been fortunate enough that everyone I've encountered for the most part is really gracious. I mean, they'll give you 30 minutes of their time and they'll tell you what they do, and some might protect some of their more, specific nuances, rightly so. But yeah, a lot of people gave me a lot of really good advice. And what's interesting though, is the one bit of advice that I kept getting from most people was to avoid large enterprise clients. And for some reason, I took everything else they told me, but for some reason, that one particular, I just didn't buy into it. I just said, no, I'm going to continue to reach out to large companies because, yeah, I figured they got the budget, they have the needs. When you see a company with 300 jobs versus 30 jobs, I mean, you know, for me, that makes sense. I'm like,
here's what I keep hearing from clients who have switched to RecruiterFlow. They are executing faster, not working longer hours, but using a platform that just makes sense. RecruiterFlow is an AI-first ATS and CRM built specifically for recruitment agencies and executive search firms. No confusing menus, no endless buttons you'll never use. When someone new joins your team, they're up and running in hours, not weeks. And here's the thing. When your recruiters spend less time fighting with software, they spend more time doing what actually matters, having conversations with clients and candidates. Several of our clients at Recruitment Coach have made the switch, and they're telling me it's transforming their operations. If you want to see it in action, book a demo at recruitmentcoach.com/recruiterflow. That's recruitmentcoach.com/recruiterflow. You already understand the benefits of posting video content on LinkedIn. The problem is time. After all, you're a recruiter, not a full-time content creator. Trusted Voice Video was built for busy recruitment business owners who know that video matters, but they don't want another job added to their plate. One 30-minute session per month gives you 30 days of short-form video content. We plan the topics, guide the conversation, edit the footage, and deliver ready-to-post videos. You'll never be stuck wondering what to say. You'll never worry about how you look or sound. We coach you through the session so you come across as clear, confident, and credible, even if you hate seeing yourself on camera. My colleague Sanjay manages the whole process. He already produces this podcast and my own video content, so if you like my content, then why not let us create yours as well? If you want your content working for you 24/7, head to recruitmentcoach.com/video and book a free strategy call.
I want the company that has 300.
Okay, but let's double click on that since you brought it up because, look, well, by the way, first of all, I love that you reached out to role models, right? As Tony Robbins says, success leaves clues. And that's partly why I do this podcast, because it gives me an opportunity to speak to, you know, Brendan Thomas and, you know, other really successful people and learn from them. So I love that you took that approach. And we'll circle back to the advice that you did take and what actually has been instrumental for you. But since you brought it up, let's talk about enterprise accounts. I know exactly why most of those other people told you to steer clear, because typically, now there's exceptions and maybe you've done it differently, but typically you don't have access to like the C-suite unless you're like, you know, Hydra King Struggles or Korn Ferry or something. Secondly, you're typically dealing with like an HR or, you know, talent acquisition person. So there's layers between you and the hiring authority. Number three, often they take longer to make hiring decisions. There's more bureaucracy. You have less feedback and you feel like you're not central, like you're not in the conversation at the boardroom table, helping to shape the decisions and the like the job spec. And, you know, therefore there's barriers to success, right? And I think that's what puts people off, is you can spin your wheels and waste a lot of time and not really get anywhere. Whereas if you deal with a small but rapidly growing company, then A, you're dealing with the top people, and B, they don't, like, if their growth is outpacing their infrastructure, you know, they don't have a talent team, or at least they have an overwhelmed talent team, and they need you, right? They have a very big problem. That means you have leverage, so you can command higher fees. Like, they need you more than you need them, right? And so it makes it easier to, for example, win a retainer, get paid a higher fee percentage, you know, and have maybe more influence over the decision making. But so you took a different tack. And what's been your experience dealing with enterprise accounts? You've obviously made it work.
Well, first of all, everything you said is 100% accurate. So could definitely not have said that better myself. And that probably comes with your vast, you know, knowledge and experience. So you're 100% correct in everything you said. And so what I chose to do was I did plenty of business development and worked with a ton of companies that were small to mid-size. One of my best accounts still ever in history was a startup. So I wasn't going exclusively after the enterprise accounts. What I did was if I did pick a niche as far as what type of jobs I wanted to fill, which for me was finance and accounting, because I didn't go to school or I didn't go to college for, you know, a finance or accounting degree. I did like a business management program, but there was a lot of accounting in there and it just made sense to me. I like numbers. So for me, I felt much more comfortable speaking to an accounting manager or a cost accountant or a financial analyst or something like that. I felt like I could carry a conversation with them. It felt like they trusted me as a candidate. And then I felt I was really good at being able to explain why they'd be good for the role that the company was hiring for. So I found that first. Then I kept my options open as far as where in the country I would go after. So to back up, yes, I definitely went after small to mid-sized businesses in the beginning and did a lot of great work with them. And I do sometimes miss how easy it is to transact with some of those companies. You're right. Oftentimes, depending on the situation, they may need you way more than you need them, and they will keep you very much involved, and they'll get you on a direct call with the hiring manager, and you know they really value what you bring to the table. So not to discredit that at all, but what I did was, if I did see a job ad for a company that was a large enterprise account, I wouldn't avoid it. I would still treat it just the same. And so the sheer volume of the volume of larger enterprise accounts that would actually reply to me was way, way lower than the small to mid-sized businesses. So I would say it was almost like a line graph where, you know, at one point they sort of intersected, and I picked up enough of the enterprise accounts year over year to where once I proved myself with those enterprise accounts, it unlocked. Basically, they're like, hey, we like working with you and your company. Why don't you just take a shot at any of the jobs we have posted? We'll let you work all of them. Then they start getting you into, you know, they give you access to their ATS. Now you're loading candidates directly in there. They give you access to the hiring manager's calendars. Now you're booking the interviews for them. Eventually, the hiring managers want to speak with you because they're like, hey, this guy's found me 3 rock stars so far. I want to talk to this guy. Next thing you know, you are working with those hiring managers. And then you're putting in bids and proposals for like 1-year contracts or even 2- and 3-year contracts. It's a whole different ballgame at that point. So, yes, I was much more successful with small to mid-sized businesses the first few years, but by just keeping at it with the enterprise accounts, it slowly got to a point where now most of my accounts are 5,000 plus employees. They do 5 to 10 billion or more per year. That takes up 75% of my year is working with those customers.
Okay, awesome. Well, look, you've hit the nail on the head as far as the big advantage of working with enterprise accounts is repeat business potential, right? That is the big draw. Whereas for a smaller company, they might only need 1 person or 2 people a year, if that, right? And so, you know, it's then you're constantly hunting for new clients.
Yeah, that I call it the hamster wheel. I call it the hamster wheel, right? Because you're constantly on it doing business development, because and you may have 3 or 4 small to mid-sized companies interviewing candidates, but maybe you place 1 or 2, right? Plus you're then when you're talking with candidates, you're constantly pivoting and pitching different companies all day long. I like being able to kind of just give the same pitch every time, and then hone in on the skill sets needed for whatever job I'm working for that larger account.
Okay, interesting. So you give a really good high-level overview of how you've progressed, but could you break that down in a little more detail? Like you mentioned, you would reach out initially and you got some response and they were difficult to work with, but you're at the stage now where you're fully integrated, you have access to hiring manager calendars and you're on longer term contracts. What did that progression look like?
Sure. I'll be honest with you. I'm still progressing in that regard. But I'll tell you from the early days, and by early days, I mean 3 or 4 years ago, it was reaching out to the hiring manager. If I saw a job, let's call it a controller, right? A financial controller for a company. I'd be reaching out to like the VP of accounting, maybe, accounting and finance. I'd hit both sides. Oftentimes they'd be willing to refer me over if I got the wrong contact. And I would always ask for that. If I sent somebody a message or left someone a voicemail, I'd say, "Hey, Mark, if you're not the right person, forgive me, but if you could just point me in the right direction, I'd really appreciate it." Most times they're willing to say, "Hey, you need to talk to Bob," and he sits in the Oklahoma office, whatever it was. But I quickly found out that some, with an HR manager, or sorry, if a hiring manager likes what you're presenting to them, and it's important to present a real candidate. I know there is some stigma in this space about sending submittals or sending out candidate profiles that's just a perfect profile for the job, and then they say, "Sure, send me that resume," and then you got to scramble to find somebody.
Right, I agree with you. Yeah,
I do think at all costs, or as much as possible, go find a real candidate that's looking for a job. It's not difficult to do. And say, "Hey, would you mind if I marketed you out to a few opportunities?" They're going to say yes. So reach out to that hiring manager. Hiring manager says, "Yes, I'd love to review this person's profile." You send them the resume. Then next thing you know, they're like, "I'm going to send this over to HR or talent and see if I can loop you in and get a meeting set up." Okay, great. Now, when HR or talent gets a hold of you, it can go one of three ways, really. It can go, "I don't know why you reached out to this hiring manager. That's, we don't allow that. We do not need your help. We have plenty of talent acquisition or support internally, and we've already got our preferred partners, so we will not be working with you." Okay. I can tell you what I do in those circumstances, but not the best first email to receive after you got excited that you might have a new
so
prospect.
What do you do in the circumstances then?
Well, back a few years back, I would say, "Okay, hey, no problem. Apologies if reaching out to the hiring manager was not your preferred way for me to go. But I would love to work with you. So, if you have, if you get to a point where you don't think you have enough bandwidth or you've got an urgent role and you want someone else to take a shot at it, I'm here for you. I'd love to try." So it's much more of a sort of passive, like, "Hey, sorry about that, but keep me in mind," right? Now that's evolved to something different.
That almost never works, by the way.
It doesn't. No, it never works. You basically probably end up in their trash bin on their email. So then I switched to, let's just say you were the person who responded to me from HR and talent. And I'd say, "Hey, Mark, thank you for the email. I appreciate that. I didn't want to reach out to you simply because I didn't even know if the candidate I was working with would be a fit in the eyes of the hiring manager. It seems like my candidate is a good fit. I'm accustomed to working with large enterprise accounts. I understand you probably have, your preferred vendors. You have your approved vendors. I'm sure you have longstanding relationships. I'm more than happy to just submit and interview this one candidate. If it ends up being the right candidate and you want to hire this candidate through me and you never want to work together again, that's fine. I really would hate to get in the way of this candidate potentially getting this job, especially if they're the right fit. So, if you're willing to jump on a call, we can talk terms and then we can see what happens." And surprisingly, a lot of companies will say, "Okay, but only this one candidate. Don't send any more. We'll test it out." And then it gives you at least an opportunity to show what it's like to work with you. And sometimes it'll lead to an actual meeting where you can say, kind of pitch what your company offers and what makes you different. And sometimes they'll just say, they'll say no. They'll say, "No, thanks. We're full. And, you can always check in with them later." I find sometimes those folks aren't even at that company in 6 months down the road.
Yeah, so. Good point. Absolutely. You start by reaching out to the hiring manager, which I think 100% is the right strategy, because if you do it the other way around, you just get blocked, right? So it's more likely that you're going to get a shot if the hiring manager likes what you're showing them in the first place, and then they, they can get in.
They'll advocate for you.
Advocate, exactly. That's the word I was looking for. Whereas if you'd had that conversation with HR, you would have had that email back straight away and you'd be nowhere, right? So it's better to beg forgiveness than ask permission in this case.
Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, it's just kind of the nature of the business, right?
You think about it, like the hiring manager is motivated. They're the one feeling the pain.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say. They're feeling the pain. Exactly. And, yeah. You know, it's sometimes when you say, you know, hey, the hiring manager is feeling the pain, you know, that might sound a little bit, you know, like you're taking advantage of the situation. But I look at it like you're not. You know, like at the end of the day, that hiring manager, when you really peel back that onion, they could have staff that are working overtime to try and, you know, cover this person who's or this seat that's empty. That hiring manager could be looking at maybe other people wanting to resign. And it's strange because I've come to learn that there can be a very big disconnect between hiring managers and HR and talent acquisition. I mean, very large disconnect to a point where, you know, some HR and talent acquisition managers feel like their job could be at jeopardy, typically more talent than HR, but maybe their jobs, could be at risk if they don't fill these jobs. But oftentimes, you know, they may just be going through applicants because they don't have enough time to actively recruit. And that's the biggest difference maker. You know, I mean, if somebody like me is constantly talking to candidates in the market and I know who else is hiring because I'm working with them and I know what they're paying, I know what their benefits are, I know their interview process. I mean, that's so super valuable if I can come to you and say, hey, Mark, I'm happy to work with you, but just so you know, ABC, you know, Technologies down the road is got a two-step interview process. They're offering $20,000 more per year. They got 4 weeks of vacation and a 5% match on the 401k, and they're growing. It's not a replacement. It's a growth hire. Whereas with your situation, the person walked off the job and the benefits and comp are far inferior. So, I mean, I'm just giving you facts. If, you know, do what you will with it. So some companies see the value in that and some don't. It's just what it is.
Awesome. No, this is great. So you said there's three possible responses. One is thanks, no thanks, right? What are the other options?
Yeah, some talent acquisition folks or HR folks, when that intro gets made, they'll be a little more lukewarm, right? They'll be like, hey, Brendan, you know, thanks for reaching out. Here's our standard terms. You know, take a look. If these work for you, then you can go ahead and submit the candidate. And then you look at the terms and they're not good terms. You know, it's like all the risk is, I'm fine to take the risk on doing the sourcing without getting paid unless they hire, but they want full refunds for 6 months. They want to, pay after 90 days. It's not terms that we can work with. Right. So then you got to kind of, you know, you got to go back and forth and say, well, here's our terms can you meet these terms? And there's some, just a dance that has to happen. And maybe you come to terms that both parties agree on. Maybe you earn their trust a little bit just based on how you treat them. And maybe you get a few more candidates over so they can see, oh, wow, he didn't just pick his one best candidate. He's actually sent us like three good candidates. Then you can get them to buy in, right? But those ones are the ones I find that are typically either HR or talent acquisition folks who've been in this a while, and they know better than to just disregard somebody because the best people they work with were once upon a time a cold call that called them and said, hey, I want to help you. And now they're their best partner. So they're more of a mindset like, I don't know, this guy might be the real deal and he could be our next best partner. So they're a little more willing to work with you.
Okay, awesome. And so where do you go from there? So now do you always start with an NPC? I don't know if you use the same term. NPC is a most placeable candidate. So it's like a strong candidate profile, someone who you think is going to help you open the door. Is that your go-to as far as starting the conversation?
Sure. Yeah. If I see, for example, when I was starting to build my desk, right, if I found a candidate that I could tell was active, whether that was through, you know, LinkedIn Recruiter, you know, you can see when people are open to new opportunities, or maybe it was an applicant for a different position. If I just knew that they were probably open, a quick message saying, hey, it looks like you're possibly exploring opportunities. I can go grab you a few opportunities and bring them to you. And you can tell me which ones you like and which ones you don't. Would that be of interest? And if so, can we jump on a quick call? So then once I've spoken with that candidate and they say, hey, yeah, I am open opportunities. This is what I need. I say, great. I'm just going to reach out to a few companies. I will anonymize your resume so that, you know, you're not getting calls or, you know, your resume is not floating around. And then I will send that candidate to whichever roles look to be a good fit. So yes, I will do the MPC method, but do it with an actual real candidate, because we all know there's nothing worse than a hiring manager say, send them, and you don't have them.
Yeah. I mean, reputation and credibility is so important. And our industry doesn't always have the best reputation, I think, because, well, we don't even need to get into that. But if you want to build something long term, then you need to operate above board. So second step is often you get shunted HR and you have that whole dance, as you described it. What happens next?
Yeah, well, hopefully if, you know, the conversation with HR goes well, and that third response I was referring to is the one that's less frequent, but is yes, absolutely. Please send us a candidate. Also send us your terms so we can look at them. And as long as your terms are within reason, they'll probably sign them. And then they'll open the rec up to you and you're off to the races. That's by far the least frequent, but it does happen. So yeah, once I've established at least a mutual respect with HR and TA, I always ask for a meeting. I'll always take a virtual meeting with them. I really am a firm believer of being able to just speak face to face, even if it's digitally or virtually. And I'll say, hey, look, you know, I'm sure you have other agencies working on this. So can you tell me what, you know, how are they falling short? What's missing? I'm sure you're getting resumes that at least have some qualifications, but what are they missing? And oftentimes it's as simple as, you know, hey, just not enough experience, or not the experience in our industry, or everyone we're getting is going to be a relocation, or they're all above the comp range we're offering. So I really want to just give them a chance to vent about what is going wrong with the search. It can come in all shapes and sizes. So then I'll take that in. And quite frankly, if I feel like I'm going to hit those same issues, I'll tell them that, but I'll tell them why. And I'll tell them what I would suggest to switch up to get around those. Right. And it doesn't always have to be the base salary or the total comp. That seems to be obviously the most sensitive for a lot of candidates, but oftentimes it's not the end all be all. I ran a poll on my LinkedIn once, I think it was a year or so ago. And I asked, you know, what's most important to you? Compensation and benefits, room for growth, work-life balance, or leadership style, right? And I was shocked to see that the room for growth was neck and neck with the comp and benefits, and so was the work-life balance, right? And so I think there's a way that you can kind of dig into what they're experiencing, where candidates are falling short, or why they're not getting to the finish line, and then kind of triage that a little bit best you can, and then then take your shot at it, right? I try to take really good job order calls. I like to try and ask deep questions. And the reason for that is for the type of positions I fill, I'd consider myself to be a subject matter expert. And I think it's important for them to know that I'm a subject matter expert. There's nothing wrong with a generalist, but I oftentimes can ask them questions where I get responses like, wow, I actually don't know the answer to that. That's actually a really good question. Let me talk to the hiring manager and see what they have to say. And then I'll say, well, if it's not too much to ask, can I be on that call, or can we all meet together? And if you ask with kindness and just be curious, you'd be surprised. I mean, a lot of companies will invite you in to the process. That's when you know you're working your magic for sure.
Absolutely. By the way, I have an old article I wrote probably 10 years ago on my website. I'll link to it in the show notes here. And it's called How to Get Access to Hiring Managers Without Alienating HR. But you just did a great job of explaining that. So it sounds like you just work your way in like the hard way. I was wondering if you had a magic solution to the challenges that are inherent in this scenario, but it sounds like you just accept the challenges, you work with it, and you try and win at every step along the way. And you're not going to win them all, but, you know, with your approach, I can see why it's working with you. So hopefully,
can I say something on that real quick?
Yeah, yeah.
This is one way that I would suggest anybody who may be listening to this. If you do go down this path or take this approach or method, you are going to be told no more often than yes, and that's okay, right? It's important to remember every no is closer to a yes, but don't be afraid at the end of the day to just ask that person, hey, look, I understand, but just curious, if you wouldn't mind, if you could humor me, what was it about my approach or the offering that just didn't entice you? Or what did I not offer to be able to get a meeting with you? And some people will just not respond. Some people will just say, oh, it was not you. It's just that I've got like 16 agencies I'm working with and I don't need a 17th one. And sometimes you may find out like, okay, cool. Then I'm going to ask next time how many agencies are working with up front so I can avoid that extra time I spent. Or they may say, you know, I really just didn't like the fact that you went to the hiring manager. Well, you know, maybe I won't change that, but okay. You know, at least I can walk away knowing why that one didn't work out. So you will get feedback from good people and they'll tell you, you know, how, and sometimes they'll say it's just not the right timing, but in February, we're going to revisit all of our partnerships. And then you're like, okay, great. Can we schedule a meeting for February? And so just don't be afraid to ask those follow-up questions. And definitely don't get discouraged when you get more no's than yeses, because that's just the nature of the business.
Well said. Absolutely. Love that. So I can see how you work your way in and get that first opportunity and then, you know, present some good people and hopefully make a placement or at least make a positive impression. But how do you transform from that, which is still, it's not a fun way to work, right? It's transactional. It's high risk because there's competition and it can be extremely frustrating. How do you elevate yourself within that business so that you do become more integrated?
Sure. Yeah, no, that's a great question. So a lot of it is going to, there's a lot of variables, right? And so there's not one perfect, simple answer. But when I have gotten to a point where I feel that we're in a good spot and this is now a team I can work with, the communication's there, I'm not waiting days for responses. You know, if I start to get like a HR or talent acquisition manager that maybe responds to me every 4 or 5 days, and it seems like it's unnecessarily clumsy or drawn out, I am not afraid to take that signal as like, this might not be the best use of my time, which I think sometimes, I know I did it early in the days, we tend to think, oh, well, if this one works out and I end up getting all these jobs, this could make my year. And it's easy to go down that hole, but don't let that blind you when it comes to the feedback you're getting or the interaction you're getting. If a client is treating you like a last resort, chances are you are their last resort, right? And so I'm not afraid to kindly, but say, hey, look, I it seems like maybe you got some other partners you're working with because I'm only hearing from you every 4 or 5 days. I don't want to waste your time or mine. When I find a candidate and they're a solid candidate, I usually work with partners that will respond within 24 hours and book the next available meeting, whether that's within 2 or 3 days. Meanwhile, I'm waiting that long just to hear back from you. So if it's not the right time or it's not the right fit, that's okay. But, you know, I want to know where we stand, right? And so sometimes, and you got to do it professionally, you got to do it nice, you know, you have to be very courteous when you do it. They'll either respond in a way where they'll respect you and they'll say, hey, I'm sorry, you're right, I'm gonna do better. Or they're gonna say, or they'll just ghost you from there and you got your answer. Or they may say, hey, this is just, we're busy, this is our cadence, if you don't like it, then I understand, right? If you are, however, getting that quick return responses and they're engaged and you can tell that they're truly wanting to work with you, then that's when I go into a mode of, I'm going to work as hard as I can for this company to deliver, and I'm going to leave no stone unturned. I'm going to find every single candidate I can within a certain mile radius, and I'm going to respectfully call, email, text, send them a message on LinkedIn, repeat until I either get, no, I'm not open to a new opportunity, or yes, let's talk. And I do that. I will go very hard, very deep, very fast for the first 3 or 4 days. Usually, and that means if I'm working 12 or 14 hour days to get them those candidates, that's what it is. Because you've done all that work up until that point, but you need to turn that corner, and now you need to actually deliver 3 or 4 solid candidates with good resumes, with realistic comp and good notes to show that you actually screen that person. Chances are, if you do that, you're going to hire one of those folks.
Okay. Awesome. This is really interesting. I noticed the 12 hour day thing in your notes, and I want to circle back to that. But, okay. So you've described your process now. So it's interesting because even when they give you that first job order, you're still sort of prospecting. You haven't decided or you haven't fully committed like you're going to go all in, right? It depends on how they respond to you. So what are the red flags that make you go, nah, I don't think I'm going to pursue that, versus the green lights where you think, okay, let's take it further and see what happens?
Sure. Yeah, it's not that creative of an analogy, but I always give the analogy that when I first start working with a company, that first job order is the first date. So it either feels right or doesn't. But in this instance, there are definitely red flags, yellow flags, and green flags, right? Red flags would be lack of communication. It would be saying no to a candidate that I submitted without any reason or feedback as to why. Because if they won't share with me how I missed the mark, then how am I going to get better? I mean, I can't keep shooting in the dark. Or if they start to say things like, we've already seen this candidate. It's like, okay, well, when and from whom? You know, like all you had to say was, we got this candidate from Robert Half last week. We had an interview and we DQ'd him. Okay, well, you know, I asked the candidate. They said they never met with you, but I'll trust you, right? Other red flags could be just simply not wanting to get on a call or a virtual meeting because, you know, people are busy. I get it. But if you aren't willing to get on a call or a meeting, that either tells me that one of three things. You're either too busy, so you're going to be too busy to work with me. Number two, it's not a priority. So maybe this isn't that urgent of a fill for you. Or number three, maybe you already have enough candidates and I'm just that last recruiter who you said, we'll throw one more in the pile, see if he gets us somebody, you know, and we'll, you know, but we've got a short list we're already interested in. And so those are probably some of the red flags. And I'm not afraid to call those out and ask them in a polite way, you know, hey, is there a reason why I haven't heard back on this one yet? Thank you for letting me know you're going to pass, but if it's not too much trouble, can you just give me a couple of reasons why? So I know, so I can fine tune the search and get you the right person. Yellow flags would be, you know, responding, saying, hey, well, you know, I'll have a call with this candidate. Here's my availability. And you look and it's for next week. And there's like two times they're available at the end of next week. And you're like, you know, this candidate could be placed by then. Right. So that could be just them being busy or having process with other candidates, or it could be them, again, not prioritizing it. So I'm not afraid to push back and say, hey, let's definitely get one of those dates locked in. But is there anything any sooner? I'm sure I can get the candidate to come in person or talk to you after 5 o'clock or before 8 a.m. Like, is there anything we can do to get this done quicker? Because this person might be gone by the time next Friday rolls around. And then, you know, some green flags would be, Brendan, this candidate looks great. We love this, and this about the candidate. We're available today at 6 o'clock. Tomorrow, we have these three time slots available. If they pass the phone screen, we can get them onto the first, you know, the in-person interview with the hiring manager within 48 hours. When I get that type of response, I'm dropping everything and I'm going to start finding them more candidates and get more people in there.
Fantastic. All right. This is great, Brendan. And so you're getting some green flags. You're getting traction. You've made your first placement here. How are you expanding that account so that you start making multiple placements?
Yeah, great. So I never ask for referrals until I've successfully placed someone and that person has started and I've gotten, I will ask the hiring manager, let's say, Mark, you're the hiring manager. Let's say the person I placed, her name's Sarah, right? That Sarah's working for you. Sarah started this Monday. It's now Friday. Hey, Mark, I just wanted to check in with you. I know Sarah started on Monday. First week in the books. I hope everything's going well. You know, any feedback? If you then email me and say, Brendan, Sarah's phenomenal. This week flew by. She's great. She's like perfect culture fit. She's going to do really well here. Awesome. So happy to hear it. Hey, just out of curiosity, I was looking at the website. I do see you have these other positions, you know, insert job title here. Do you know anybody, do you know who's hiring for those roles or do you happen to know anybody in that department? And if so, would you mind maybe just giving a friendly referral, you know, if they're happy with the person you hired for them and you give them that week to let them, you know, settle in, you'd be shocked. I mean, sometimes they'll just immediately reply to you with that hiring manager on copy and say, hey, Brendan is interested in your, you know, financial analyst role. He knocked it out of the park with Sarah, who started with me this week. Brendan, feel free to, engage. But I don't think you should ask for a referral until your candidate has started and they have at least a week with that candidate. You don't ask somebody to review if you have a restaurant, you don't ask them to give you a good review until they've eaten the meal, right?
And then right.
If they're happy, like, hey, would you do me a solid and give me a good review, right? So you wouldn't ask for a good review and then the meal's awful and then they feel like you took advantage of them. So anyway, that's just kind of my approach to it.
Fantastic. So like you're building on success, right? So have your first success, then you're getting referrals, that leads to more opportunities and things are snowballing from there. You mentioned like, then getting to, because I think that's what perked my ears up is when you said you're getting direct access to hiring managers' calendars so that you can book the interviews in yourself. Tell me about a situation, an account where you've achieved that and how did you get there?
Oh, sure. I have a perfect example because I dealt with it this week. It's important on how the relationship starts and how it goes. If you are finding that the HR manager or talent acquisition manager, depending on the environment, has made it very clear that they want to control the process, then don't mess that up, okay? Don't go reaching out to the other hiring managers. But if you do have, at some point, a hiring manager gets added to an email, right? You see they're on a calendar invite. It is okay, again, if that person ends up hiring your candidate, it's okay to email that hiring manager after that first week or first 2 weeks and say, hey, Mark, I just wanted to check in and see how Sarah's doing. You know, that's okay. HR should not get mad at you for that. They shouldn't. I've never encountered that, at least. But be very careful when you go to ask for a referral with another hiring manager. That could be a whole different conversation. But if the HR and talent acquisition managers are very clear about they will tell you what jobs you can and cannot work, respect that boundary, right? Then it's about meeting with that HR manager and just saying, hey, I shot Mark a friendly email just to thank him for, you know, working with me and checking on how Sarah's doing. He replied back, sounds like Sarah's working out great. I wanted to thank you as well for trusting in me and giving me a shot. Now, I did notice you have these other jobs, and I'd love to help. Are any of these priority for you? And, you know, either myself or someone in my team that has expertise in these will work on it. That's that one way, right? But your question is, how do you get to a point where eventually you're working with a hiring manager and you're getting access to their calendar and things like that? If the company's HR and talent team starts to trust you and they realize that they're better off getting you in touch with the hiring manager because they know you're going to do a good job, they can trust you. It's typically companies that have budgets for recruiting, so they're comfortable with the spend. Then they're going to be more likely to say, hey, Brendan,
my engineering manager reached out. He needs a manufacturing engineer. I'm just going to loop you in with them. I hope that's okay. I'm like, of course, no problem. And so then you're working directly with that person. Depending on how the call goes, if they are very bullish on wanting to hire someone quick, or it's a very urgent hire for them, then it's not out of line to say, hey, how would you prefer, what's most convenient for you? What's going to be most efficient? Would you like me to just send you every candidate with a write-up about the candidate and add their availability in there? Or do you have the ability to give me access to your calendar and just set parameters, like you're willing to speak to someone between 8 and 6, 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. And if I see a slot, I can book it for you. I would say it's a 50-50. Sometimes they'll say, no, just send me the availability. Sometimes I have things that I got that aren't on my calendar or what have you. Other times they're like, oh, that would be genius. Please do that. Yes, I will give you access. And usually it's through like their ATS or what have you. So it just depends. But asking is not, that's not an inappropriate thing to ask. It's actually—
Definitely. Okay. Yeah. I love it. So you're just straight up asking and saying, look, would that be helpful? And look, people don't talk about this enough. I'm not sure why. I was always trained that interview slots are like that. Sign of commitment is so valuable. So we were taught, even from the job board or call, that you then say, okay, when do you need someone to start? What's the consequence if they don't start by then? Like, what impact does that have on you, the team, the deadlines that you've got, etc.? What's the consequence of that? Okay, so it's super important and urgent you get someone by then. So how long's your interview process? Okay, 2 weeks. That means you really need to be interviewing like the week after next, so that you're in a position to have someone start by then. What days are you looking to interview that week? You know, what have you set aside? Because let's just block out some time to make sure this doesn't slip, because I know it's important to you. And they give you the times and you say, look, can you give me 5 times that I can just book the best people straight in? And by the way, if I only have 2 that I'm really confident in, I'm only going to use those 2 slots. But that will just speed up this whole process so that we're not going back and forth and losing people.
Absolutely.
Right.
And so you nailed it 100%. And that's it must be funny interviewing people for this podcast, because you're very humble, but it's obvious that you are very high level at this job as well. Because that all the people that I know that bill $1 million plus, $2 million plus, that's how their relationships are structured. They build the trust. They get, 4 hours of that person's week, 30-minute blocks. So they got 8 blocks on that person's calendar. And that hiring manager trusts that they're going to just put the best of the best on there. They're not going to fill it with a bunch of, 75% matches. It's like, no, if they get a calendar invite or something goes on their calendar, it's going to be a 90% or better match, and they trust them. So, yeah, I mean, you obviously know how to do this job at a very high level too. So,
well, thanks, Brendan. When my primary objective on these calls is to learn from you. So I try and just do mostly listening and instead of talking. Thank you for the masterclass on breaking into major accounts. That was really interesting. And I can't believe we're almost at an hour. There's so many things I wanted to ask you. So maybe you'll come back for part 2 sometime later in the year. I did want to ask you, though, like, I know you're available because you recruit nationwide. You make yourself available from 5 a.m. to 5 p.m. Pacific. And so you average 60 hours per week of uptime. So first of all, how do you define uptime? What does that mean?
Yeah. So, correct. I do work from, coast to coast. So it's important for me to be available at 8 a.m. Eastern, even though I live on the West Coast. And when I say available, I mean available for anything. I'm available for a virtual meeting. I'm available for a call. I'm available, whatever it is. That's true uptime. And then I will work until, at very least, 5 p.m. my time Pacific, because, I got to work normal hours, which would be 8 a.m. Eastern. So yes, it is a 12-hour window. It's 5 a.m. to 5 p.m. Pacific. So during those 12 hours, I could pick up a virtual call. I could pick up a phone call. I can screen a candidate. My schedule is open. You can book with me during that time. Of course, when I look at my calendar in the morning, if I've got a couple slots, I might click one and say, take the dog for a walk or something, right? Because I got to keep some form of sanity. But that doesn't mean that I am not doing work before 5 a.m. or after 5 p.m. I'm offline and I'm doing busy work. I might, log off at 5 and I'm no longer available for calls or videos, unless it's an extraordinary circumstance. But then I'm sending candidates. I'm following up with, the candidates I sent the last few days to see if we're going to get interviews, or I'm booking interviews. I'm doing offline work. So I don't consider that part of like my uptime. So really, I don't know how many hours a week I work, but this is truly a job where I do like what I do, and it allows me to earn enough income to take care of my family, which is my most important thing. That's my why. And I can do it from anywhere. I take several vacations a year. I do still keep my phone and my laptop with me, but it still feels like a vacation. I don't mind it. And I genuinely enjoy what I do. I like helping people. I love working with businesses and learning how they work and helping them grow. So for me, if you put me in a bank from 9 to 5, that would feel like the longest day of my life. But in the job I do, the days fly by. So it's okay.
Awesome. All right. Listen, that was a lot of fun, Brendan. And thanks for sharing such, like, you got really tactical, which I think people always love tactics over theory. So appreciate that and love to do this again sometime.
Oh, yeah. It'd be my honor. And you're great. I love your content. So to be involved it's my honor.
Okay, to wrap things up, let me highlight a few very practical takeaways from this conversation. First, pay attention to how Brendan breaks into enterprise accounts. He doesn't start with HR. He leads with a real candidate and goes straight to the hiring manager. Not a hypothetical profile, a real person who is genuinely open to a move. Once the hiring manager sees value, they become the internal advocate who brings HR and talent acquisition into the conversation. Second, notice how he earns deeper access over time. Brendan doesn't ask for control up front, he earns it. After delivering strong candidates and making a successful placement, Brendan asks the hiring manager what would make the process easier for them. In some cases, that leads to access to the hiring manager's calendar so Brendan can book interviews directly. Third, he's very clear about the reality of enterprise work. It's still slower. There are more layers. You will hear more no's than yeses. The difference is that Brendan is willing to do the work that most people aren't. Long hours, relentless follow-up, and walking away when the signals tell him that an account isn't worth the time. Those are my takeaways. I'm curious what stood out for you. Let me know what your biggest takeaway was in the YouTube comments. And if you got value from this episode, be sure to subscribe to the podcast. I'll see you next time.